This is a Media Lab podcast. Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show, and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert. If you hear the revving of engines in the background, it is because 3 inches of snow fell last night, and everyone is getting stuck on the road outside my house, including me. So I'm parked like 5 blocks away from my house. It's been a great morning. I have a few items at the top of the show today. First, an actor and writer by the name of Matt Steele on his podcast said some very nice things about me in this show. His podcast is called Two Gay Matts, and he hosts it with his roommate who, get this, is also named Matt. So, of course, I was very appreciative and bashful about the praise he heaped upon me, but I wanted to check out his film that was released this year called Devos, like the male version of Diva, and with an exclamation point at the end, so you know it's good. I had a blast watching this movie. For musical theater junkies, it's got some great jokes packed into it. It's funny, has some heartwarming scenes, and legitimately, I did not predict the ending, which is not easy to do anymore, I feel. Now, while it's not available in every country, I definitely check it out on the VOD platform of your choice, or you can visit their website for more information. I'll put all that into the show notes. I don't know if this sounds like I'm reading off a script, but I had a really great time watching it. I thought it was really, really good. And there's two things, which is like I love to support other artists, but I also want more unique voices being shown in film and television. And I think this goes a long way to do just that. Here's just a little snippet of the trailer.
Here he is, boys. Here he is, world. Here's Ricky.
A high school musical.
No, never, never do it like that.
Sounds lame, no. But here in our blessed hallways of St. James School, you might say that each and every one of us is a star on the rise in our high school musical. Trying to find a moment to shine without stepping on each other's toes.
Oh, look at you, Mitchell. Now maybe you'll learn how to act.
Dine a fire, bitch.
It isn't easy.
My name is Ricky Redmond.
Ricky Redmond himself. Quick, someone grab my autograph book.
I was never just your average boy.
You can ask my mom.
Ricky's always had a flair for the dramatic.
Stop taking pictures right now!
I can't think of a more perfect role for you your senior year.
You're not afraid of being upstaged?
When has anyone ever upstaged me?
My spring is open, so I figure, why not?
I'm sorry, what?
I know that Josh Kelly has a lot of...
Second, I mentioned it when I talked with Christine today, but I am going to be an upcoming guest on her podcast called Bottomless Broadway. So in the new year, you'll get to hear me talk about Merrily We Roll Along. So prepare yourselves and subscribe to her show now. Christine has been a guest many times before. Her last appearance was in our Follies season, where we talked about In Buddy's Eyes. And the time before that was in our Company season for You Could Drive a Person Crazy. So if you enjoy this episode, you can go back to those episodes to hear more. If you haven't been able to figure out, she is one of my favorite guests to have on this show. If you'd like to support this show, you can always do that for free by rating and reviewing it on whatever podcast app you use. Algorithms, you know, are a tricky thing, but it does help the show become more discoverable. Of course, if you'd like to help monetarily, which will only help to grow and make the show better, you can do so over at our Patreon page. Do not donate if it impacts you negatively financially. This week, I have some bonus audio of Christine and myself that, you know, straight off the point, just a bit too much. And we talked about the musical Soft Power and the plot structure of A Little Night Music. Also over on the Patreon page, a huge thank you to the God That's Good tier, the Holy Triumvirate, Jack, Todd, and Barry. Well, now it's time for Plotting Along. Plotting Along is the part of the show where I fill you in on what's happening in the plot of the musical. At the beginning of the show, Frederick had surprised his young wife with theater tickets to see the new Desiree Armfelt play that has come to town. So they arrive at the theater, but because Frederick whispered Desiree's name while sleeping, Anne is a bit suspicious of their past relationship. While in the audience, Desiree and Frederick lock eyes, and then our quintet appears to sing what maybe they are thinking about. Let me go thank some sponsors, and then when we return, it'll be me talking about Remember with Christine Chen. Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by the Calgary Foundation. Whether it's funding anti-racism programs, addiction recovery, or food hampers for the hungry, for 65 years, the Calgary Foundation has proudly supported the charitable community to address some of Calgary's biggest challenges. Now, during this period of unprecedented urgent needs, Calgary Foundation renewed its commitment to building a healthy, vibrant, giving, caring, and resilient community. If you're a registered charity looking for a grant, a professional advisor creating a giving plan for your client, or a donor wanting to give back to community, discover a wealth of resources at calgaryfoundation.org and learn more about their work through Calgary Foundation's Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. This week we're also brought to you by the Alberta Podcast Network, so let's go and listen to one of our other great shows. Hi, my name is Kyle.
I'm Dave.
And I'm The Machine.
And we do a podcast called Kyle and Dave versus The Machine. It's a podcast where a sentient machine is forcing us to watch movies in order to prevent it from initiating the apocalypse. Although, Dave, you and I tend to talk about the ideas of the movie rather than the movie itself.
Well, it's the machine's fault, like everything, and then by effect your fault, Kyle, that you've invited me, and this is the only thing I like to talk about.
I mean, I'm not going to face the apocalypse alone, so you seem like a good patsy to bring along with me.
If you wanted somebody that was going to give you some hope, you picked the wrong person.
Kyle and Dave vs. The Machine is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, locally grown, community supported. New episodes are out every Friday.
Remember
the tenor on the boat that we saw had belching the bottom ride.
Christine Chen, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you again, Kyle, for inviting me another time. I'm glad haven't, made the blacklist or anything.
Not as of yet. We'll see how close you get this time. I think where I want to start, if you're willing to talk about it, is, since the last time you were on here, there's been a lot of stuff that's happened.
That
there's been a global pandemic. There's been a U.S. election. How are you doing just in general?
Better now that the election has passed and we have a conclusive answer. My politics haven't really been a secret, but I am pretty happy that Joe Biden has won. And that, for me, brings a lot of hope for the future. Still just kind of getting through the days.
Yeah, no, I get it. When we're recording this here, at least, which isn't going to be actually super long before I actually release it to the public, it is looking better in New York State, but the surrounding, I guess the entire United States is basically in like this bright red color when I look at the map,
which isn't promising. They talk about it like the third wave or something, but I think this is still like the first wave just moving across the country. How's Canada doing, by the way, or like where you're at?
Awful, actually.
Oh, really?
We were doing okay throughout the summer and really into like the first beginning of fall. Here in Calgary, at least, like the most that it was at, like as far as like cases, active cases in the city, 300 was the peak.
Oh, wow.
And currently, since winter has kind of started to set in where I'm at, I think right now we have, oh my gosh, like almost 3,000 active cases going on. So it's basically exploded since kids have gone back to school and the cold has set in. So they're talking about possibly doing a second shutdown. So we'll see. We'll see where that goes.
I always just assume that Canada was a lot more responsible than the U.S.
Well, it seemed like we were crowing about it. We seem to be doing an okay job. And it just there's a few people who decide that they just don't want to follow things for the greater good. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
One thing also I want to mention here, too, is that I was a guest on your podcast.
Yes.
Although that probably has not been released yet, although time is weird
right.
when you do these things out of order.
So it'll be maybe like 2 or 3 weeks before our episode is out.
Oh, great.
We're scheduling it for the beginning of January.
Excellent. Yeah. So if you want to take a look at Bottomless Broadway, you should go and check that out so that you can hear that conversation. We talked a little bit about, well, not a little bit, we talked a lot about Merrily We Roll Along.
It's like a sneak peek before this podcast gets there.
I know, exactly. So it's going to be, oh my gosh, probably a couple of years until we're going to get into to that, at least a year and a half or so. So yeah, you can kind of hear my thoughts on that show in a little bit more detail. Now that you have jumped into a little bit more of like the Stephen Sondheim oeuvre, are there themes or stuff that are jumping out to you, or are there shows that you like more than others?
Merrily has definitely sort of risen to the top for me. And mm-hmm. I mentioned it in our episode with you where I saw it and like kind of didn't really bat an eye at it. I like didn't think too much about it. But having listened to the score and like sort of ruminating on it more, it's definitely been something that comes back to me a lot. I actually listened to it a lot at the beginning of the pandemic because I think I was just feeling nostalgic for better times. And I do like, I have this like sort of growing fondness for Anyone Can Whistle.
Oh, nice.
And it's, I mean, so much of it is actually relevant to the US political situation also, that it's mm-hmm. it's kind of crazy how they sort of like villainize the people who are established professionals, or like, I don't remember what they called it. All the cookies were actually like the name for them was like, oh, they're like great thinkers or something. And that's why right. they're crazy. And I'm like, well, that sounds kind of familiar.
Something that I came to a realization of, because my feeling has always been, well, not always, but since I've done a deeper dive with Anyone Can Whistle, is I really love the music in that show. I just think that the book itself is a bit of a mess mm-hmm. to try and get it all to come together. However, that being said, do you know the director Charlie Kaufman by any chance?
I don't think so.
So his, I'm going to say his most popular one is probably going to be like Adaptation and, he didn't direct that one. He directed Synecdoche, New York is what he directed years and years ago. And he's a bit of a screenwriter, too. Anyways, he came up with this movie that's on Netflix that I'm now blanking on the name of because it's a weird name. But what's weird about that movie is that it literally is, it's not a musical in any shape or form until there's an actual dream ballet that happens at the near the end of the film in classic dream ballet style. They like shows you the themes and stuff that's happened throughout the movie. And I was watching this and that moment happened. And I was like, oh, you know, if anyone can make Anyone Can Whistle work, it's Charlie Kaufman. Because I think he's just weird enough to figure out a way to like break it apart and like bring it back into its like component themes.
You know, it might work better for film than on stage.
I think so too. I think you can cut out the stuff that you don't need and just really focus on.
And like transitioning between the sort of two different plot lines, I think would make a lot more sense on film than trying to like figure out, like make sure you sort of pay enough attention to all of them on stage. Yeah.
And you don't need the two intermissions, which is nice too.
Yeah.
Now, I was curious then, because we're here to talk about A Little Night Music in general. When's the first time you got introduced to A Little Night Music?
So it was, like most people, through Send in the Clowns. Mm-hmm. But the version that I first heard was probably not a version that anyone else first heard, which was a cover by Rebecca Kane, who is a soprano, and she was actually the original Cosette in the London version of Les Mis, as well as the original Christine in Phantom of the Opera when it premiered in Canada. And so I was sort of like obsessed with her for a bit, and her voice is gorgeous. And so I was looking at what else she had done, and there's a cover on YouTube that she's sung of Send in the Clowns. And I had no clue what the song was, and then I was like, wow, this is a great song. You know, when you've like hear something or you learn about something and all of a sudden it's everywhere. And it was like the next year was when we had the Winter Olympics and Yuna Kim skated to it, and I was like, oh, I know this song.
Oh, interesting.
And I think I'd heard the Miller's Son probably in cabarets a few times, But I think those were the two main songs I knew from it. So I thought that A Little Night Music was this like very profound, deep rumination.
Right.
Which it does get there at times, but it's really not that at all.
Yeah, no, it's really is trying to be a sex farce for the majority of this, of its runtime. But it's interesting. I'm very much looking forward when we get to Send in the Clowns because, I don't know, that song is just fascinating to me that out of all of the things that Sondheim has written became like his most famous song. There's a lot of stuff to be said about that.
Everyone's confused about, like Sondheim's confused about it. People who like are very serious, like musical theater essayists are also like, this isn't, you know, his breakout song, but it became that.
This song in particular, this Remember song, though, you know, I'm recording some of these episodes out of order, but I do want to have a bit of a conversation about the quote unquote quintet that sings this song, which is essentially like this Greek chorus that kind of walks throughout the show and fills in some of the gaps of what's going on in the plot a little bit. But as you and I were kind of discussing before we hit record today, I think we're both aligned in thinking that they're a bit odd, I think, in the structure of this show, when you could have the same things being sung by the characters in the piece. But what did you want to bring up, I guess, about the actual quintet?
I think it's interesting the way that they both sort of start and end the show. They're like, because the start of the show, they, you know, show up on stage and they like vocalize an overture. And then you see the rest of the cast start picking up. And so I guess it can kind of be seen as an audience insert where, you know, if you go back to the title, Little Night Music, you're sitting down at a piano, or like if you were in, you know, 1900 Sweden or something, maybe in the evenings you sit down at the piano and people play and it's like a very sort of polished affair. And this is sort of the way that they're choosing to introduce, oh, we're going to have a little night music. And then it turns into like this sex farce, as you said. But then at the end of the show, they kind of go back to that where the same quintet, they don't really do much, I think, at the end of the show, but they still sort of close the show. So it's kind of like, this was a night, even though in the show, I don't think night ever happens, but that's a different story.
Yeah, it's hard to really see in the show itself. The movie that it's based on, that it took inspiration from, it's very clearly night when all this stuff is happening at the end of the show, but yeah, not so much in the musical itself. Where I'm, I guess, the most confused, I'll use that word, confused, is that I've never been 100% sure who these characters actually are. Like, are we meant to think that they're just there to like usher the audience along? Are they actually supposed to be characters in the show?
They all have names, which does make it confusing.
Right. And so I'm not 100% convinced that even some of the creators know, because the story goes, I don't know actually how true this is, but what I've read is that Sondheim came to Hugh Wheeler, who wrote the book of the show, and was like, I need to have a quintet. And Hugh Wheeler was basically like, oh, I don't have any way to, like, there's no reason I need to have a five characters in the book of this. He's like, well, make it happen. And then he kind of just walked away from that. So this is a thing that Sondheim had obviously in his mind that he wanted to play around with musical style and with these characters. But I don't know how committed the rest of the creative team actually was to that idea.
Yeah, I want to say it was in the Finishing the Hat book, but I can't find it. So it might have been somewhere where he talked about how he wanted to use the quintet to sort of like stop the story from being too serious, almost, just to be like, hey, by the way, you're watching a show. It's not necessarily like supposed to be look at these events that are happening as much. It's like supposed to give it a more lighthearted feel, but I cannot find it now. So I might have.
Yeah, that's the absolute worst, when I know I've read something and then cannot remember actually where I read it on. I think the other thing that needs to be addressed here, too, is that the song, Remember, there is a bit of a footnote that Sondheim writes after this song specifically. I'm just going to read the first little bit of it here, where he says, This is the lyric equivalent of a trompe-l'oeil painting. It fools the mind, not through the eye, but through the ear. It is certainly possible that Desiree and Frederick's long-ago affair involved the incidents mentioned in the song. Luckily, the audience is misled by the smooth phrasing, the flirtatious images, and the smattering of truth and the specifics of the incidents into not listening to what the song is actually saying, as have all the actors, directors, songwriters, critics, and correspondents who have been involved in or commented on the show. Not one has ever questioned me about it, to my embarrassed relief. The fact is that I simply became so enthralled with the brittle, easy-to-write quality of the song that I ignored logic for laughs. I haven't often done that, but whenever I hear this example or one of the others, which I shall not name, I shudder with a mixture of pleasure and shame. So essentially what he is trying to admit here is that he doesn't believe that the character Frederick would be as promiscuous as he would be in this song. He's too buttoned up to actually have performed that. And Desiree may not be married, but she believes in long relationships. That's what his interpretation is. So essentially this idea that they're being sung but in Remember, he thinks is completely untrue. And yet the audience is led to believe that it is true.
Right.
Unless you have a different interpretation.
Well, so the part, when I've read this footnote like 5 times, and I'm still a little confused by it because he mentions that he ignored logic for laughs. So I guess like when he's saying, I think you were there, that, and like, I'm sure it was you, that's supposed to be a laugh line, which it is in the show. But I feel like that, like if he wanted a laugh, there could have been so many other things that he could have put that weren't that. So it seems strange that he would be embarrassed about these two particular lines when it seems at least somewhat intentional. And that's kind of been where my confusion is on. But as for what he's saying, I think there's a way to interpret this where those lines are still there and they don't necessarily lead promiscuous lives, which also I'm not completely convinced that Desiree is not necessarily a believer in long relationships or anything, because I don't think we've really seen anything to either effect.
Well, I was going to say that because literally the song that precedes this is The Glamorous Life. And in that very song, in the original Broadway cast version of that song, it mentions how she has ancient admirers and new lovers or something like that. Mm-hmm. That are constantly fawning over her, with the subtext being that she, you know, has relationships with these people. So I don't know where that idea that she only believes in long-term relationships, I don't know how 100% true that actually is.
Have you watched the original Bergman film?
Yes, I have.
I haven't seen it, but is that a characteristic of Desiree at all? Is that why he thinks that, maybe?
Yes, is the quick answer to that. She is, if anything, a much more strong-willed character, I think, in the Bergman film. She puts Frederick in his place pretty quickly when he comes to her door, even though the same basic plot is actually there. No hip bath, though, in the original film. So I'm thinking that's where Sondheim is getting this from, but I don't know if that's actually in the book version of A Little Night Music, is where things get kind of a little bit weird about this. So I think maybe Sondheim is a bit of a different interpretation than what Hugh Wheeler has for writing the book.
Yeah, I think, and again, we don't really hear much from Desiree or even Frederick about their past relationships besides the ones that show up on stage. So who are we to sort of make that judgment about them? And it does seem like from The Glamorous Life that Desiree, even if she's not as promiscuous as, you know, this song implies, then in The Glamorous Life, she at least admires how promiscuous her position can make her, even if she doesn't take them up on it, I guess.
Yeah. I guess the next thing is that, do you read this as actually being, like, is the quintet singing the inner thoughts of Frederick and Desiree, or is it something different?
I see it as kind of the quintet is separate entity singing to them, like, because when it first starts, it's when they first meet each other or their eyes meet on stage. And so I kind of see it as like the two that are singing the first stanza of this are kind of singing to Desiree and to Frederick, like, oh, do you remember this? And sort of interposing their thoughts, I guess, but not necessarily, it's not necessarily their actual mental monologue, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Which is interesting, because I've always kind of seen this as the inner monologue happening. Although, if that were true, and this, I'm going to do something that they tell critics never to do. But if I was to rewrite this show, why anyone would give me that power, I don't know. It makes a little bit more sense to me to have it literally be Frederick and Desiree singing their inner thoughts to each other. And in a theatrical space, you could do this even with lighting, where it's like spotlight on Frederick as he sings, and then lights come up, spotlight on Desiree. So we know it's like their inner monologue. It's not them actually talking back to each other from the box and from the stage and stuff like that. Regardless, that's not what happens in this show. So we're forced to make our own interpretations.
Yeah, I think it seems to me like it's more something where it's not their conscious thought, but something is like tugging at your memory.
Right.
And yeah, that's just how I interpret that scene.
I guess to further that thought, Desiree actually doesn't know if it's Frederick or not 100%, because she mentions that later on in the show, which is like, I thought that was you up there, but I wasn't sure.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be kind of what we're trying to draw in here, is like these half forgotten memories of an old flame that kind of flutter into your mind. Again, it's been, what, 14 years or something that they haven't seen each other for. So it's not like immediately, like as this was like last year that they had a fling with each other. So it's kind of those half forgotten memories of like, I think it was blue, maybe it was red, that it was a boat that we were on. Anyways, as the older I get, I kind of understand where they might be coming from.
Yeah.
So to that point, let's jump into the lyrics here then. So this is sung by the quintet. What they sing is this. The old deserted beach that we walked, remember, remember. The cafe in the park where we talked, remember, remember. The tenor on the boat that we chartered belching the bartered bride. Ah, how we laughed. Ah, how we cried. Ah, how you promised and ah, how I lied. That dilapidated inn, remember, darling. The proprietess's grin, also her glare. Yellow gingham on the bed, remember, darling. And the canopy in red needing repair. I think you were there.
The old deserted beach that we walked, remember.
Remember. The cafe in the park where we talked, remember.
Remember.
The tenor on the boat that we chartered belching the battered bride.
Oh, how we laughed. Oh, how we cried.
Oh, how you promised and oh, how I lied.
That dilapidated inn, remember.
The proprietress's grin, also her glare.
Yellow gingham on the bed, remember, darling.
And the canopy in red needing repair.
Anything immediately that you want to call out about those lyrics?
I think it's cool how he chooses very specific glimpses of memory. Like, none of this is actually... Mm-hmm. Oh, remember when we were vacationing, or remember when we visited? It's just like sort of small sensory images. And I think that is sort of how, like, if you have old memories that you don't remember super well, that is kind of how you remember them. And it's not necessarily about what you were doing. It's just about the feeling like you're back in that space again.
Yeah, you know what, this actually immediately comes to mind. Have you ever seen the movie, and I think there is a stage version now, of Gigi?
No, I haven't.
So there's a song in that where the old couple sings back and forth, and it's kind of similar to this, actually, now the more I think of it, where it's like we walked at night, it's like, it was at 6, or we walked at night, it was at noon, it's like, I took your comb, it's like, you actually took my glove, like, they kind of sing back and forth, it's like, you're not getting this 100% right.
We met at 9.
We met at 8.
I was on time.
No, you were late.
Ah, yes? I remember it well. We dined with friends.
We dined alone.
A tenor sang.
A baritone.
I remember it well. That dazzling April moon.
There was none that night, and the month was June.
That's right. That's right.
It warms my heart.
It's kind of a similar thing where, yeah, it's like those, it is specific that what they're remembering, but we're not 100% sure if it's like actually true at right. the same time. Some things about this. So there's some great alliteration. I liked the belching the bartered bride. How familiar are you with that song or that opera, I should say?
I only looked it up and it's apparently a Czech comic opera from like the 1860s. And that's all I know about it.
Yes. I'm trying to probably butcher this man's name, but I think it's Bedřich Smetana, which my document very lovingly auto-corrected to Bedrock Smetana, which that is not his name, although that would be a great one. I know this. My first like really obsession as I was growing up was classical music. And so as my parents knew this, for Christmas, they got me once this 3-CD set of the best overtures of all time, or so the makers of it thought. Anyways, one of them was the Bartered Bride overture. So I actually know the overture to the opera very, very well, because I've listened to it for many, many years. And in fact, why don't we just put a little portion of that in here right now? Yeah, so it's a fun little reference here. I don't think it's necessarily commenting on anything in particular. I just think it's a nice little bit of specificity
that
he's throwing
into
there.
It works well with the word chartered.
Yeah, exactly. Chartered and bartered. But the other kind of reference I just want to talk about, because I'm a big idiot and did not have a clue what this is. Do you know what yellow gingham is?
Isn't gingham like a type of cloth pattern?
Yes, it is. For whatever reason, I don't know why I never just looked this up years ago. I thought it was like, I don't know, like a perfume or something that they were like sprinkling or something like that on the bed, which doesn't make a lick of sense. But yeah, gingham is like, in a similar way to like paisley, it's a pattern. It's not actually a color. It's a pattern of material. And to me, when I looked this up, it is like your classic tablecloth pattern. That's what it looks like to me. So kind of like checkered almost.
Mm-hmm. I've always known Dorothy and Wizard of the Oz as wearing blue gingham, which I think is the reason why I know the word. And I think she's always described that way. But yeah, it's that sort of just lines going in perpendicular directions.
That's right. I do want to call out the fact, though, that we have a bunch of, or at least a couple of what I call like $5 words here. The fact that he is able to put in dilapidated and proprietesses.
I love the word dilapidated.
Yeah, dilapidated is a good word. And is able to throw in proprietresses. Like that's a 5 syllables that you have to go into there to get that right. Boy, like I don't know many people who try and throw those words into like an offhand lyric.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's... I think it also speaks to the intelligence of these two characters that even despite however you interpret this song and the duo that's singing it, who have like the quintet has names. It's Mr. Lindquist and Mrs. Nordstrom. But right. Regardless of how you interpret the positioning of this song in regards to the characters' minds, you still sort of... It still, I think, speaks to the intelligence of the characters and how they would recall these specific ideas in their memory.
Now, one thing I realize I've done again is that normally I like to give credit to the singers of these songs. The only unfortunate thing is that I could not get 100% knew what their names were for each of the productions that we have. So I did not include them here in this piece, but just so people don't think I'm just... forgetting them intentionally. So, these people who have interesting names, which are not actually written into the Finishing the Hat book. But I like the fact that there's some sort of backstory that you can write for them.
Yeah.
The other nice thing is that in the 2009 version, the 2009 Broadway version revival, if you have never listened to A Little Night Music before, I might suggest using that as your first introduction, because it actually includes some of the talking bits in between. So it gives you a kind of a sense of how this would be structured, because this song is actually not sung all the way through in productions. There's actually bits of dialogue that happen in between some of the stanzas, because Anne basically storms out of the play that Desiree is performing while this song is actually kind of happening back and forth. So if you want to kind of hear what that sounds like, that's a good place to start. Mm-hmm.
I really like that cast recording.
Yeah, it's fun. You know what I haven't said this yet. At least I don't think so on the show yet. My introduction to the 2009 revival was the Tony Awards that happened that year,
mm-hmm.
and where Catherine Zeta-Jones performed. I think she performed Send the Clowns on that telecast.
Of course, right,
yeah, she did. So apparently, what a lot of people have told me, people I trust, is that it was just a bad performance that night, unfortunately, and that normally she actually did a really great job in that production. But because that was my only introduction to that show and to that revival, I came away thinking like, oh, this must be a really bad production, because I really disliked how she performed Send in the Clowns on the Tony Awards.
It's funny you say that, because when I had my brief obsession with Send in the Clowns, where I was sort of looking up every version of it, I actually was like pleasantly surprised by hers, because I know she's not like a super big singer. Yeah. And I think she is great in Chicago, the movie.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
But like it wasn't the Tony Awards, but I think it was just on iTunes or something where I listened to her Send in the Clowns. And I was like, she can like sing and emote and, mm-hmm. you know, all the things that a musical theater actor normally does. So I was pretty pleasantly surprised by that.
I think the issue with the performance at the Tony Awards is that it, for whatever reason, she did a very staccato performance. It's like, Send in the Clowns.
Oh, I'm interesting.
Like, stop it. Like, I can't deal with this.
Yeah, that's not the point. But
anyways, we're not talking about Send in the Clowns. That's just right. Me being offhand. Here's how it continues. The local village dance on the green, remember. The lady with the large tambourine, remember. The one who played the harp in her boa thought she was so adept. Ah, how we laughed. Ah, how we wept. Ah, how we poked and ah, how we slept. How we kissed and how we clung. Remember, darling, we were foolish, we were young, more than we knew. Yellow gingham on the bed. Remember, darling, and the canopy in red, or was it blue?
The local village dance on the green. Remember.
Remember, the lady with the large tambourine. Remember.
Remember, the one who played the harp in her boa thought she was so adept. Oh, how we laughed.
Oh, how we wept.
Oh, how we polkaed. And oh, how we slept. How we kissed and how we clung. Remember, darling.
We were foolish, we were young.
More than we knew. Yellow gingham on the bed, remember, darling, and the canopy in red.
Or was it blue?
So anything you want to call out about this section?
I think there's a couple of things. In the beginning of this section where they have longer phrases, it's like the difference between seeing a picture and a video, I'd say, between the first section and this section.
Yeah.
And they seem to sort of be closer together in memory. Like when they switch off who sings it, they seem to be continuing a train of thought from the previous person, whereas the opening few lines seemed like very separate images. So I don't know if that's just like they're both remembering more of their affair together. I feel like I spent a lot of time on this song just like pulling things out of thin air that may or may not be
no, what I was going to mention too is basically along those lines that this middle section to me feels like if you have like good friends with people, sometimes you can just look at each other and kind of know what the other person is thinking,
because
mm-hmm. you have that shared experience with one another. And this is what the middle section to me feels like, where they feel a little bit more in sync with mm-hmm. one another, where they are finishing each other's sentences and going back and forth, and they're like, yes. And then we come back to like, remember this, and then that's where I think people they're not as confident
right.
with each other as they go back.
I think the other way to sort of interpret that, that also goes back to the I think you were there line.
Yeah.
Because it's the man that says, or was it blue, and also the you promised and I lied. And so it's kind of like the man shedding doubts on these what are supposedly shared memories, which
right.
if we want to get really metaphorical, can be Frederick pulling away from Desiree. And like both of these two characters are sort of very established in their relationship to their relationships. In that like Desiree knows sort of where she is with Count Malcolm, Carl Magnus, and Frederick, you know, has just remarried within the past year. And so they sort of know where they stand with their personal relationships. But when I think when you sort of see like a like an ex or something, or even just like anyone in general, it's kind of like you don't want to seem like you've spent more time on thinking on your relationship with them than they
right.
have.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's why I think like the line, I think you were there, doesn't necessarily have to mean that Desiree and Frederick are promiscuous people. It can just be like, oh, well, I don't want to seem like I was too invested. And like, I yeah. don't want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that interpretation though a lot. I think that that would be a really neat way to try and make that like super obvious in the line reading that you were doing, right? It's like almost like I often like, I think you were there instead mm-hmm. of like I think you were there, the way that they normally sing it to like really hammer home that they might actually be forgetting each other, where it's like, no, I want you to make you think that I'm forgetting
yeah
our time together.
And like also with the or was it blue, like she's mentioned the canopy being red before, that wasn't an issue before, or yeah. actually it was him that mentioned the canopy the first time. And he mentioned it as red. So now it's like, oh, well, now maybe we're too in sync. I don't want to,
yeah.
you know, sort of rekindle this. And like, I'm going to shed some doubt on it.
Mm-hmm. I really noticed in these few stanzas that we just read off here, too, that he's bringing a lot of color as well. Like the village dance on the green, which I know is not the color necessarily, but using green, yellow gingham, red or blue. So like he's really using those evocative colors mm-hmm. to like make those memories happen. I do want to just mention too, the actual rhyme scheme of this song is not like the most complicated. It's basically like every other line rhymes essentially. But there's just a few sections that I think are just really well constructed. Like how we kiss and how we clung, we were foolish, we were young.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nice how that fits together. And even like the yellow gingham on the bed and the canopy in red. I mention this seemingly every single episode, but I'm going to continue to do it. But Sondheim is just so good at making a lyric that actually rhymes almost sound like it isn't rhyming, like it's just a thought that somebody has. And I think that those are great examples of that, that they fit so well together that it feels like a complete thought, and yet it's a rhyming couplet at the same time.
Yeah, like I think, I mean, this is a pretty strange circumstance, but I feel like you could speak these and not
mm-hmm.
be and not have it sound super stilted. Though also back to the line of we were foolish, we were young, I think mm-hmm. that's a clever line to put in here, which is still fairly early in the show, where they're like, oh, we were foolish because we were young. But
yeah.
as we'll find out later, Desiree and Frederick are the fools of the show, and they're like not young anymore.
Yeah, they're not young anymore, for sure. Well, this is how the song ends here. They sing, the funny little games that we played, remember. The unexpected knock of the maid, remember. The one that made us both rather merry and oh so very frank. Ah, how we laughed. Ah, how we drank. You acquiesced and the rest is a blank. What we did with your perfume, remember, darling, the condition of the room when we were through. Our inventions were unique, remember, darling. I was limping for a week. You caught the flu. I'm sure it was you.
The funny little games that we played. Remember.
Remember. The unexpected knock of the maid. Remember.
Remember. The wine that made us both rather merry and oh so very frank.
Oh, how we laughed. Oh, how we drank.
You acquiesced.
And the rest is a blank.
What we did with your perfume,
remember,
darling.
The condition of the room when we were through.
Our inventions were unique. Remember, darling.
I was limping for a week. You caught the flu.
I'm sure it was.
The only little note I'm going to make is that the 1995 version actually changes that last line. Instead of, I'm sure it was you, they go back to the, I think it was you.
I think it was you.
Which, I'm not quite sure why they decided to do that, because I actually like the original ending a little bit more. But be that as it may, what do you want to pull out from this section?
A few things. This is where sort of the rest of the quintet comes back in, because up to this point it's only been two people singing back and forth,
right?
And now we have the rest of them again, and I think the images kind of also change in tone. Like it's a little bit more playful, less about a sort of romantic affair and more just like, oh, we were just playing around. It was a fling. I think the ending is, I do like, I'm sure it was you better, because it can still play to that sort of similar coyness that if you just want to imply that you've had more romantic partners than you've actually had, or just right. Be like, oh yeah, like maybe I'm making this up and it's making our love affair sound like it's more grand than it actually was. But, you know, who are you to object to that?
Yeah, like for me, I think what's interesting about this section is it does feel like an extension of the lyric before, where like we were foolish, we were young, where it really feels like they're regressing a little bit here in the last little bit, because it feels like a younger couple being wistful, because it's like, you know, we destroyed this room, right? It's like we got woken up by the maid. Like it's kind of like how rock stars talk about like wrecking rooms and that sort of stuff when they first start touring and that sort of thing.
Our inventions were unique. No one's ever done things the way we've done things.
Exactly. It's like, except every single person has, but yes. so that's kind of what I noticed here. And it kind of brings back to some of this like larger words that Sondheim is actually using in this one. Like acquiesced is not an easy word to just throw into a lyric here either. So yeah, it's like, simple as this song is, I think that there is a lot of like complexity that he's throwing in here with like lyrics and the music and stuff that's put underneath it. It is meant to evoke a time in what we, I think the audience is supposed to understand as these two characters' lives, but it is also kind of like these universal truths of like forgotten love affairs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it also, it still sort of puzzles me a little that we don't know more than we do about Desiree and Frederick's original affair.
Yeah.
Because we don't know how long it was for. We don't know if he was cheating on his first wife. We don't know like how, if they thought it would be something more and then it didn't. We get maybe a few hints to that in Send in the Clowns. And we know from the book, Desiree says there was a little rancor after they broke up. But obviously they're still in love with each other. But she was at least able to play it off when they first saw each other as, oh, we're just good old friends who are doing each other a favor. So we don't really know much else about, like, for all we know, all of these could be false and made up, and they're just sort of like, oh yeah, let's just make up these wonderful images. But we really have no clue.
Mm-hmm. Which I will say is also like another difference between the original Bergman film, is that like I've always found it like somewhat hilarious how quickly she's like, yeah, I'll help out an old friend because you're not having sex with your current wife. That does not happen in the Bergman film whatsoever. So
how does that end up happening?
They are just having a conversation about their love affair, and then Carl Magnus appears.
Oh, okay. Like, so they don't actually
they don't actually ever have it until like the end of the movie.
Oh wow.
But it was the 50s. I mean, it was a different time.
They had to be more maybe it was like they didn't want to say it out loud.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing I will say that always makes me laugh, and I don't know why, because it's not really a laugh line, but it just seems so like out of the blue, which is like, you caught the flu. It's like a very specific thing. It's like, but wait, why are you including this in this song? Like, I get the I was limping for a week. Like, you know, people say that all the time. Well, not all the time, but people will say that when they made love. But the you caught the flu just seems like out of kind of nowhere for me.
I
and yet it always makes me laugh.
I wonder if it's like you caught the flu, so then we couldn't see each other anymore because, like, you know, or something like that. But
I can see that. Yeah, maybe that's what it's trying to refer to.
It does seem like that's like the last line before I'm sure it was you.
Right.
Which is like, all right, cool. That's how it ends. We're done now.
Well, yeah, it just seems like it's trying to like marry those two concepts. Like I was limping for a week and you caught the flu. So like, was he sick when they came? Like, I don't know. It doesn't really matter. I don't think there's some deep meaning behind this, but it's just a weird thing to like kind of equate with each other.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think this song alone would be really interesting to stage as like a dance on its own without scenes or something, like kind of like a dream ballet.
You could
but,
do it.
You know, with, because in the first section of the song, it's kind of like if you're at a party or something and you're like dancing with people and you kind of see the other person, you're like, oh, do I approach them? Do I not? And they sort of like reconnect or something. And then the second part is like, maybe they're like, okay, well, maybe I have to go. You know, I can't show my cards. I have to go dance with other people now. And then the last part is kind of like, oh, like still trying to keep an eye on them, see what they're up to, even if you're dancing with other partners. And you're like, oh, well, gotta go. I caught the flu, I guess, or something like that.
Yeah, right. It gives you a good excuse not to go and do stuff for sure.
Yeah.
So I guess overall then on this song, having listened to the whole score, like where do you rank this amongst the other songs of A Little Night Music?
I like it better than the other quintet songs. Mm-hmm. I think this is probably my favorite quintet songs. Also, Act Two hits you really hard and heavy with the quintet.
It does. There's mostly just quintet songs. I agree, because as much as I like the music of the two night waltzes that happen in Act Two, they're basically nothing songs, like really at the end of the day. There's not much that they're doing.
Yeah, I can kind of see why they exist. I don't see why two of them need to exist.
Right.
And Sondheim was like,
and there were supposed to be three.
Yeah, Sondheim wanted three. But they say essentially the same things. And it's weird because all of a sudden the quintet is more involved in the storytelling there. Like they're the scene setting songs, but they haven't really been up until that point. And I think that's why I like Remember better.
Yeah,
because it does, I think, mark kind of a shift in attitude from the characters and sort of create a specific ambiance for the audience as well. Mm-hmm. But as compared to like the regular character songs, I think these are more waltzes. They're like an opening ballet, a dream ballet. Like I'd rank it sort of like that, where it's not something that you would listen to on its own. But it would be like, if you're going to listen to the score, this is very much a part of the fabric of the score.
I do like your idea of someone actually trying to stage this just as like a short, like one act type of thing. Not even a one act, just like a piece in and of itself.
Yeah.
In fact, if any producer is out there and wants to pay me money, I could probably actually make that happen, like construct a night, because I could see doing that with a few Sondheim songs. Specifically, I want to do one for Country House, where that is basically a short play in like 6 minutes. So get at me, Broadway, when you reopen.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming back on here again, Christine. If people wanted to stay in contact with you, what's the best way that they can find out what you're doing online?
So you can follow me on Twitter at Across the Arch. And then my aforementioned podcast is Bottomless Broadway, which is also on Twitter and Instagram at Bottomless B-Way. So any of those channels, you can kind of see what I'm up to.
Thank you once again, Christine.
Yeah, thanks again for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Also, you can follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Thank you to the Alberta Podcast Network and to the Calgary Foundation this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. Next week, we'll be talking about You Must Meet My Wife, Well, wouldn't we just? As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.
Why did she look at us?
Shh. Dear Madame Merville, what a charming mischance to find you here this evening.
I don't think she looked especially at us.
Charming indeed, dear Celimene.
She did. She peered and then she smiled.
Oh, dear Countess, I implore you to reveal to me the secret of your success with the hardier sex.
She smiled at us.
Dear Madame, that can be summed up in one single word.
She's ravishingly beautiful.
Makeup.
Dignity.